Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Aaron Newcomb joins me. We're going to be talking about Node.js. It's everywhere, and more people are using it every day. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Aaron Newcomb. Episode 387, recorded May 10th, 2016. Node.js update. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, simple and fast cloud hosting built for developers. Deploy an SSD cloud server in 55 seconds. Try it today for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com. And once you sign up, be sure to enter the promo code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit. And by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price, because everyone deserves a great night's sleep. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/floss and enter the promo code FLOSS. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, Libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stunninge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day and unaware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show and start playing with it. Today's subject is no exception, but first let me bring on my co-host, Aaron Newcomb. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Randall. Good
hey,
to
cool,
be here.
Cool. And for those of you watching the video, you'll see, once again, I am actually in downtown Santa Monica, hanging out at ZipRecruiter up on the 11th floor. So you can actually see in the background here, you can see some buildings down there and maybe even the ocean. Yeah, probably can see the ocean from here. And I'm really enjoying these new classrooms, these new conference rooms up on the 11th floor because they give me a really nice background instead of just closing everything off. And there's no chance of the sun coming through the back window. And Aaron, it looks like you're in a familiar place.
Yep, same place as usual in my study here. Surrounded by all my goodies. So,
yeah. Well, today's subject is probably near and dear and familiar to many, many members of our audience because we're going to talk about Node.js. Now, we typically don't do a show twice on the same subject, but the last time we talked about Node.js was with Matt Rennie back in episode 237 in, can you believe it, January 2013. That's like 3.5 years ago, and at least by my math, something close to that anyway. But apparently there's been a lot that's happened. Node has forked. The fork's been brought back into the fold. A foundation was set up to help coordinate everything and all sorts of great stuff. We talked a little bit about Node.js in last week's show to try to get a sense of what that is, but I really do want to take people all the way through. If they don't have never heard of Node.js, I want to kind of get an overview of what you would use it for. But I also want to talk about the politics of the situation that happened fairly recently with the IOJS split and the remerge. And the real expert on all that stuff is going to be on today's show. His name is Michael Rogers, and he's going to be coming on in a few minutes. What do you know about Node?
So Node keeps coming up more and more, at least in my sphere of influence here, as I do a lot of stuff around the makerspace. Some guy brought in a one of these little electronic startup kits, basically, which is a little microcontroller, and it had all these sensors and stuff. And I thought it was like an Arduino, which runs C++. You know, you just plug it in, you program it in their little IDE, and you go. But no, this thing was running Node. It was using Node.js for everything that it did, and it actually reported out to a web page somewhere on their website in order to get the sensor information off those temperature sensors or whatever, light sensors. You actually had to go request the information from their website. And it was supposed to be like an Internet of Things type of device or a starter kit for the Internet of Things. So it was really, really interesting. And there's also there's a Node platform. I forget. It's IBM's platform. It's like a drag and drop quick constructor kind of thing, web-based thing that you can get on the Raspberry Pi as well. I think it's called Red Node or Node Red. I'll have to look it up or the chat room can tell me what it's called. Anyway, so I'm coming across this more and more lately from a maker perspective. So now I'm kind of getting interested in Node.js more and more as I see how it's being used, especially with the Internet of Things and people creating new devices and so on.
Okay, very cool. I should also mention that Michael Rogers is the community manager for the Node.js Foundation, so he's definitely a person of interest in order to be able to describe the things that I introed with in a minute ago. So, but before we bring Michael on, I have a very important message. Because whether you're developing an app, a website, or working on a server-based project, you need flexible, reliable, and affordable hosting. DigitalOcean offers Droplets, which are virtual private servers that can be customized and deployed easily to host websites, web apps, production applications, personal projects, virtual desktops, and almost anything else you can think of with full root access. This helps you get your project off the ground quickly and makes it easy to scale when you find success. DigitalOcean is used by over 600,000 developers, including me. I first found out about DigitalOcean back last year at Linux Scale, Southern California Linux Expo, and I've had a server actually running for 15 months now and have been very happy with it. You can deploy and configure your droplets via a streamlined control panel or a simple API. You can choose your OS, Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, Fedora, CoreOS, and FreeBSD. That's mine. I use FreeBSD all the time. I select from one of the many pre-configured one-clicks like Drupal, Docker, or Node.js to get up and running quickly or to build the exact infrastructure you need. With root access to servers running 100% SSDs, and boy, are those things fast, in the state-of-the-art data centers around the world. It's highly scalable to meet the demands of a rapidly growing application or business. You can also use advanced features like floating IPs for high availability, private networking, and automated deployments via API. They have an extremely active community with a large and detailed set of tutorials on all the ways you can use your Droplet. Want to configure a LAMP server? Set up a virtual desktop or VPN? They've got you covered. And it's so easy to get started. You can deploy an SSD cloud server in as little as 55 seconds. DigitalOcean has incredibly affordable and straightforward pricing. Servers start at only $5 per month. There's also hourly pricing available starting at less than a penny per hour. But we're going to make it so you can get started today and deploy an SSD cloud server for free. Visit DigitalOcean.com and create an account. Once you confirm your email and account information, go to the billing section and enter the promo code FLOSS for a free $10 credit. That's plenty to get started and explore what DigitalOcean can do. That's DigitalOcean.com, and once you sign up, enter the code FLOSS in the billing section to get your $10 credit for free. We thank DigitalOcean for their continuing support of FLOSS Weekly. And now let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Michael Rogers. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Cool, cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
San Francisco, from my home in San Francisco.
Oh, very cool. Well, I'll be up in your way probably about 8 weeks or so. So anyway, cool. So I gave sort of the overview, but let's step back as if someone doesn't know what Node.js is, or maybe has an inkling of an idea, but doesn't know the area of things that Node might be used for. Can you start from there and give us the story?
Sure, sure. So Node is a JavaScript platform. So the best way to think of it is that it is a platform. So you can do, you know, pretty much anything with it. You can, you know, any compute environment that it runs on, you can kind of do a lot of stuff with. And it started back in 2009. And the whole idea behind Node was that JavaScript didn't really have a platform that would run on all these different compute environments. And JavaScript was also very efficient because of all of these battles from the browser wars. And it also was a really good fit for non-blocking I.O. And being very, very efficient with I.O. because there wasn't a threading model inside of JavaScript at the time. So since then, we've done a ton of work to make it incredibly fast, incredibly efficient. VMs have gotten much, much better. And through that entire time, one of the things that happened in computing is that all of these different environments that we need to work in started to get more and more constrained. So we started to see JavaScript kind of go everywhere. And Node is kind of the thing that's bringing JavaScript everywhere. So it's bringing it, you know, to mobile devices through Cordova and desktop applications through Electron. And it's bringing it to like all these new front end applications like, you know, React and Babel. Those are all written in Node. And also, as you were mentioning earlier, on IoT devices now, on device inside of Intel and Tesla and a lot of other great people. So we're really seeing kind of this explosion of like a new full stack that you have to contend with where there are all these different compute environments and Node is kind of the thing that's pulling them all together.
Okay, now just to clarify, when I hear the word JavaScript, I'm thinking something in the browser, but this is really nothing in the browser. This is actually a standalone application that runs things that browsers could possibly talk to with the HTTP modules, but we're really talking about a VM, a standalone application that has maybe multiple threads or doing all sorts of activity.
Right, right. It's similar to, you know, something that you would write in, you know, Python or Go or Ruby or anything like that. Except the main difference is that we're using the language of the browser. So if you were talking, you know, in a browser and in the back end, you would have the same language and a lot of the same utilities. And we're kind of able to leverage a lot of the web and a lot of different web technologies in all of these other compute environments that traditionally did not allow you to use web technologies.
And I understand it's an event-driven framework. Can you describe more about what that is?
Well, I think event-driven is pretty – anybody who's done development on the web is used to events, right? When you click on something, you have an event handler that pops off. So if you think about, you know, network programming or programming APIs, like HTTP calls and network calls and file system calls, like those are just now events that happen. So, you know, this thing will happen in the future. If it's an IoT device, I trip over a sensor, so I have a little handler on that. That's an event that goes off, and then I decide what to do with that.
Okay. Now, Am I looking at this as a text file and I'm writing code like a normal, say a Python program?
Yes. I mean, if you want to use a giant IDE, you can, but I'm certainly a fan of text editors. Actually, in Node, you know, every file is a module. So when we talk about modules, we're really talking about individual files. And then you're really able to package up modules and publish them into NPM, which is now the largest package ecosystem in the world, actually. So there's a ton of different modules for you to choose from. And each of those modules usually just kind of do one little thing, and they're very easy to understand. And then, yeah, in your little text editor, you just write your own scripts and pull all that stuff in, and it works really well.
Yeah, and darn it, no, NPM passed CPAN up, I guess, about two years ago, maybe a year ago.
Yeah, it's been crazy. It's been growing incredibly fast.
Does it now? Of course, I'm really familiar with the CPAN. Does it work kind of like the CPAN, where I can just sign up to get a user ID and publish my stuff to NPM's central repository?
Yep. Anybody can sign up. Anybody can publish whatever they want. It's similar to CPAN in that way. I think one of the things that sets NPM apart from other module systems is that a lot of module systems have a kind of global namespace. And Node doesn't really have a global namespace for a module. So if you say you import a module by name, you're actually going to get a version of that module that is local to your package. So this allows you to, for two packages that you depend on, to essentially require two different kind of conflicting versions of the same package. So this has allowed people to really independently publish stuff without worrying about overlap or trying to, you know, figure out which one of these dependencies that we're both dependent on that are different versions and stuff like that. So that's one of the reasons why we've been able to grow so quickly and create such a huge ecosystem and have people really leverage and depend on it.
So what kinds of things would use Node? Give me some of the range of possibilities.
Yeah, I have a funny story about this. The first conference I ran in 2010, NodeConf, we asked like the panel of the main Node people at the time, what should you not do with Node? And pretty much everything they said not to do with Node are now some of the biggest areas of Node. So we tend not to try to talk about what you shouldn't do with Node anymore, because time tends to prove us wrong. So one of the biggest growth areas that we're seeing is IoT. IoT development is really, really taking off. Not just you know, in the higher power stuff, but now also we're seeing it in lower power devices. So Intel's Galileo is incredibly low power. The new Tesla 2 is lower power than the first Raspberry Pi that ever came out. And those all run Node on device. Also, I think that the way that you do front-end development has changed really dramatically in the last few years. And a lot of that is because of Node. Node has now created a platform for people to build these really advanced compiler tool chains so that people can do, you know, not just linting, but actually cross-compiling down from, you know, other newer languages and adding features to the language that cross-compile down. And even, you know, things like React. I mean, React is a front-end web framework, but it's the first front-end web framework that you don't include in a script tag. You actually use it as a compile chain built in Node.
About some of the things you're just talking about, Internet of Things, and of course that's really top of mind for me as well. So I'm just kind of curious, can you talk about some of the things that you've seen in terms of Internet of Things people do with Node.js?
Sure. So we had one of the earliest kind of drone communities, people really playing around with drones and doing really fun stuff with them. Usually at first with the AR drones, kind of like in a hobbyist community, but a few people came out of that whole community and have built like really, really cool stuff. So one's company is Skycatch. They're actually like a commercial drone company. So they do they go into a lot of construction sites and kind of surveil the whole construction site and stuff like that. And that's all in Node. Every kind of sensor is set up with a little Node process on it. So that's one of the more like really impressive things that people have been doing lately. I'm trying to remember the ones that I can talk about and that I can't talk about. Trying to recall here. That's one of the more kind of like bigger commercial kind of enterprise ones that we've seen. Also, you mentioned Node Red from IBM. They have a lot of people that they're working with and a lot of like, you know, really kind of stellar stuff that they're putting together as well. I don't know if you saw the Kickstarter for the Silk device. It's like a IoT connector for your home. That's using a lot of Node.js as well. That's from the team that had built Firefox OS kind of created a new startup and is doing this great Kickstarter. A lot of Node going on there as well. There's there's a lot that I'm trying to recall that I cannot talk about. But yeah, it's a really high growth area for us for sure.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was looking at using it for was a a board for our makerspace that when you came in, like it could have different sensors around the makerspace saying, you know, hey, this tool's getting hot, or this area over here. You could even have like air quality monitors and say, hey, you need to turn the ventilation on because this is, the air quality is getting bad over by the welding machine or something like that. Just different monitors and different sensors, and then put those all up on a board in the front of the space when you come in, so you can say, oh yeah, we need to go take care of this, or here's the top projects of the day, something like that. There's been a couple, and the ones that I've tried seems like they've been written in Node. And it just seems to be really good for those types of things. You mentioned the drone thing. I mean, for the software on the drone, I mean, they're not running the actual the core of the drone on Node.js, are they? I mean, they're just controlling the sensors, or are they running the whole thing on Node?
The whole thing is Node.
Wow.
A lot of these architectures, when you get into the more advanced robotics, they start to look a lot like the Tesla. So the Tesla is sort of built like as a network of API interfaces for each individual sensor, which is why they can do really interesting stuff with software updates, right? So when you get into some of the more advanced kind of robotics, they start to get very, very complicated if you treat them as, you know, we have this one core and then all of the logic is just kind of pouring into it. Instead, you sort of build each component sensor as its own little API, and then you kind of tie everything together. And Node is very, very good at that kind of thing. It's very, very good at building out APIs and processing data and being incredibly efficient. And when there's no data to process, you know, not taking up a bunch of unnecessary resources. The use case that you were just talking about, you know, taking a bunch of sensor data and getting it onto a board, there's a lot of stuff in between just getting the sensor data out, right? You've got to get it into an API somewhere that can store it, and then you've got to build a front end and, For building out that backend, there's a ton of Node services that you can use. You know, every hosting company supports Node very well. And even all of these new serverless architectures like Lambda and Azure Functions and Google Cloud Functions, those are all on Node as well. So you can use it to do all the data processing. And then if you need to build a front end, guess what? Like, it's also going to be JavaScript. Even if you want to have like a desktop application, like a lot of your favorite desktop applications are actually probably written in Electron. The Slack app is written in Electron. Visual Studio Code is written in Electron. I can't believe Microsoft's editor is written in JavaScript. But it's been really, really great to see. Like the new great applications that you really want to build isn't just one little thing. It's tying all of this different stuff together. And when all of those are in a different language with a different debugging tool chain, it just gets more and more problematic, and it takes longer for me to, you know, create something interesting to people. So we're just seeing a lot of really cool creative stuff in Node.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the part that's so surprising to me is when I think of anything with JavaScript, I think of the web, and I think it's going to be slow and it's not going to be as fast as I need it to be to do, you know, all these instructions as quickly as possible. Especially it's things like temperature sensing or reading a value that you want to react to very quickly. I never think of, because I associate JavaScript with web. I never think to go there, I guess. I always think, I'll go do that in C, or I'll go do that in even Python or something like that. And some of the people in the makerspace with me are like, no, you got to go do that in assembly. And so it's just interesting to me to hear about all this stuff. Do you find, is that a common reaction for newbies, I guess, like me? Is that something that you find when people come, they say, oh, I don't want to use Node.js for that because it's going to be too slow, or it's not built for what I want to do?
I think it was. I mean, certainly when we started out in 2009, 2010, that was the reaction. But even back then, I mean, JavaScript had become a very competitive language. It's incredibly fast. I mean, I'll put JavaScript VMs up next to any other VM. It's incredibly, incredibly fast. I think a lot of the issues that people have with the browser is actually in DOM performance. It's not in JavaScript performance. JavaScript has been really performant for a long time now.
That's interesting. So one other question is again, going back to me as a newbie, if I wanted to go learn this, what's the best training resource? Should I go take a class from, I don't know if Udacity or something offers a class on Node.js? What's the best way for me to get started?
Well, so we've in the foundation, we've actually done a lot of work around trying to understand how people learn and making sure that they have all the resources that they need to learn. And we're building out a couple new ones, but we're really impressed with just the diaspora of resources that exist for Node that have really been created by the community around Node. So, I mean, if you're the kind of person that learns through MOOCs and likes online courses, there's one in pretty much every course system for Node. So, you know, whichever one that you're already comfortable with, there's going to be one there. You know, we have great documentation. If you Google anything about Node, you're going to find a really good Stack Overflow article or something about it, if that's how you learn. There's also an amazing community called Node School that's created a bunch of interactive, you know, self-starter courses where, you know, they give you a challenge and then you type it and it tests if it actually worked or not. And you can learn everything from basic Node to, you know, WebGL. And it actually does, like, you know, diffing of the 3D model in your browser. It's really, really impressive. And there's a community there that not only has built out all of these utilities, but there's also a community that helps support them and will answer your questions and stuff like that. And there's also, if, you know, if you're the kind of person that really needs to sit down with somebody to get over the first hump, there's a global community around Node School of, you know, bringing people in locally and doing all of these workshops together. So, you know, there's, I think, over 300 places now across the world that are doing this. So I definitely check out nodeschool.io if that's the kind of learning that you do.
Rats, now I got to spend even more time learning stuff. it's never ending. I don't have time to learn all the stuff I want to learn and play with. So this is built around the JavaScript V8 engine. Is that right?
Yes. So our default engine is V8, and it has been since we started. But one of the things that's shifted in the last year or so is that we're moving towards being a little bit more VM neutral. So, for instance, Microsoft put Node on top of the Chakra engine, and it actually works quite well. And there's a few benchmarks that are really impressive there. And that got Node into Xboxes, and it got Node onto Windows 10 IoT and Windows phones, all because we're running on Chakra there. So they ship a version of Node that runs all of that. And it's fantastic. And now they're doing that integration work actually inside of the Node project, inside of the foundation. And, you know, there's now also a Spider Node project that people are doing to try to build it on SpiderMonkey as well. So, yes, our default engine is definitely V8, but we're trying to move in a direction that is a little bit more VM neutral.
Okay, now, I think JavaScript is a cute language, but I don't like programming in it. It frustrates me a lot because things don't work the way I always want them to. Can I use a higher level language like, say, TypeScript or, say, whatever all the other ones are that transpile to JavaScript? Can I use that with Node?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, all of those work in Node. And those compilers are written in Node. So, yeah, those are definitely all great. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in fact, the Visual Studio Code Editor is actually built in TypeScript. So all compiled down to Node into Electron. So.
And would it also be possible to, say, run a Dart program compiled to JavaScript in Node?
You could. You'd be one of the only people using Dart, though. But, yeah, you would. Yeah, that's not a hugely popular one. We don't see a lot of that. We see, TypeScript is definitely growing. CoffeeScript is kind of coming down, actually. A lot of the people that really liked, CoffeeScript, I think, really like the new ES6 and ES7 features. And so there's a lot of compiling, you know, newer JavaScript that we don't actually support yet down to the JavaScript that Node supports. So that's a bit more popular. And also TypeScript is definitely a growing contingent as well. I think a lot of the people that were doing Dart have kind of moved over to TypeScript. So,
okay, that's fair. You keep mentioning Electron. I don't know. I had to step away for a moment. Did you also mention Atom?
Yeah, the Atom editor is you know what Electron was built for. So yeah, the Atom editor and Visual Studio Code are both written on OJS.
Cool. All right. So let's go back to something that is sort of interesting and maybe somewhat controversial. How did io.js happen and why?
Okay. So the creator of Node very early on went over to work at Joyent, and Joyent sort of assumed responsibility for shepherding the project. And this was, you know, hugely beneficial for the project. I mean, there was a lot of marketing resources thrown into it. There was a lot of, like, professionalization that happened around Node really early on that was really important. But, you know, Node grew faster than, you know, any other open source platform that we know of, actually. It's still growing at 100% a year, which is crazy. And eventually that growth was just so much more than any single company could really really keep control of and understand. And the way that the project was being managed was through kind of a more traditional BDFL model. And over time, it just wasn't attracting contributors at the rate that the project was growing. So the few contributors that were still there were just like overburdened with the maintenance of the project. And eventually, a bunch of the contributors to Node really just disagreed with how Joint was running the project. Now, there was never a disagreement about what Node is or the technical direction. It wasn't like, you know, this group of people wanted threads or something and, you know, went off and created this fork. It was really just about, you know, how do we run the project and how do we execute on all of this? And can we create a more participatory model than the BDFL model? So that was IOJS. And IOJS succeeded, you know, at bringing a ton of people in and bringing like a lot of new enthusiasm to the project, a lot of contributors to the project. But also because it wasn't called Node.js, it didn't really have to deal with the stability and maintenance requirements of Node as well. So Joint, you know, started the Node Foundation and put it into a neutral body and really opened the door for IOJS to merge in and for the governance model for Node to shift over to basically what IOJS was doing. So now we could take a lot of the stability and maintenance and like things that people really rely on in Node.js and bring this whole new contributor base and this new way of governing a project to bear. And we really were able to kind of take both of the core competencies and merge them back together under the Node Foundation. So that was great.
So was that the beginning of the Node Foundation when those were brought together?
Actually, the Node Foundation was started a little bit before that. So before the projects could be merged, there needed to be a foundation. So Joint created the foundation and then, you know, opened the door for a merge to happen. And then the IOJS governing board sort of voted on coming into the Node Foundation and merging back with the project. So there was a little bit of a delay in there, but.
Okay, then we've noticed in projects that don't yet have some sort of independent guidance, you know, like if Joint's the only one really contributing to it, it does tend to stagger or what's the word I'm looking for? Stumble a little bit. So I'm glad it kind of all moved out and got into something like this. What are the foundation's responsibilities?
Well, as far as the project goes, I mean, the foundation really gives full autonomy over to the project. So there's a very sophisticated governance model for Node now that is really built around creating a more participatory software model. We spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, what does really highly sustainable big software look like in the GitHub era where, you know, people are showing up to do four lines of contributions? You know, how do we gear a project so that, like, those contributions are valuable and that we can continue to scale and continue to level people up. So we've been able to go in a year from about 5 to 70 committers to the project, which is tremendous. And so those committers have a consensus seeking model, and then that feeds into a technical committee that makes any kind of hard decisions that happen. And we're just, you know, cranking out releases, and we have a huge focus on stability. There's been a lot of like test fixes and stuff like that. And there's a really diverse community at every layer in the project, whether it's the website or the tests or the documentation. So that's been great. So that's one side of the foundation, which is this autonomous area controlled by the contributors. And then the other foundation side, the board side, is mainly members and the donating members, and the individual members also elect a few representatives to the board. And they handle a lot of kind of more traditional marketing and PR and legal work to make sure that, you know, the project is, you know, in good legal basis and we have good IP policies. And also that, you know, we can compete with projects that are backed by big companies, you know, like Java or .NET. Like we want a little bit of that traditional marketing and PR so that we can, you know, bring Node to as many people as possible.
Cool. So we've actually had a couple technical questions in our chat room. We have a live chat room as we're going through the show. People are sort of curious about threads versus the way Node does it.
Okay. yeah. So, I mean, Node uses non-blocking I/O, right? So when it's processing data, it's not doing any other processing, which is, you know, as a programmer, I mean, if you've probably done threaded programming before. I think a lot of your listeners have done threaded programming. And I've used a lot of languages like, you know, Erlang and different kind of concurrency patterns. And what it really comes down to is how do you get your head around state locks and when do I have a lock on state and when can the state mutate? So in JavaScript, it's actually really easy to understand that. Because you have functions and you have closures, right? And in between these function boundaries, like, things can change, because when my function gets handled, I know that I have a lock on all of the state and I own all of the processing. And Node is very, very efficient at that processing. And then when I'm done doing that processing, we're going to take the next thing of IO that's in the queue. So it allows us with very few resources, much fewer resources than you would in a threading model, handle a lot of concurrency, a lot of like concurrent I/O happening without concurrent processing. You know, you're usually I/O bound. Like you can saturate I/O a lot quicker than you can saturate processing for the most part. There certainly are cases like, you know, big scale data processing where that is not the case. But even in that big scale data processing, you actually do map reduces and you spread it over a ton of independent processes anyway. And so we actually end up doing that fairly good as well. But yeah, that's the difference, is that we don't do concurrent processing. We do concurrent I/O. And we can do concurrent I/O a lot faster than you can do concurrent I/O using concurrent processing.
Cool. And how do these various event handlers talk to each other? Is there a communication path or global variables or something?
Well, I mean, you can create global variables. You can have, you know, variables in closures that are, you know, between where you're hooking in these handlers. It's really up to you as the programmer. So it gives you a lot of flexibility, but also, you know, isn't a huge loaded gun pointed at your foot that says, you know, oh, you know, you don't know when state is going to mutate. So yeah, I mean, like if you wanted to do something like a counter, you would just say, you know, var, you know, I equals zero, and then add the handler, and then, you know, you would mutate that variable. But you know that, you know, when your handler fires from the top of that function to the bottom of that function, that state is not going to mutate in between because nothing else is happening like it would, like it might in a threaded model.
Oh, I know Aaron has a couple questions to ask, and that we have a very important person to come in and tell us something about something he really cares about.
Hey, I don't want to interrupt. Great conversation, but for just a moment, can I talk about my mattress? Okay, I know that sounded a little weird, but I happen to have the best mattress ever, and I got it on the internet. I'm talking about Casper. Hi, this is Leo Laporte. And Casper Mattresses, our sponsor today on Floss Weekly, is a manufacturer and retailer of premium mattresses made in the USA. But because they don't have a showroom, you get these mattresses at a really great cost. You're buying direct from the manufacturer. And sometimes as people say, oh, that's, I want to lie on my mattress first. This is the best part. Of course, a showroom's a lousy place to test a mattress. Trust me, I know. I've bought many a bad mattress because you're lying. It's bright daylight. The salesperson's looking at you askance, and you're lying there with your shoes on going, well, I think I could sleep on this. This is not good. What you want is you want an in-home trial, and that's what Casper does so great. So first of all, these mattresses, super compact. This is a queen size I'm opening if you're watching the video. It comes in a compact box. I got one for my son's dorm room because he could get it up the stairs and into his dorm room. But then when you open it up, and it's wrapped in Tyvek, and they give you an opener and everything, it just goes, and now it's this beautiful full-size queen mattress that is the most comfortable you've ever seen. It combines two technologies, latex and memory foam, and just the right sink and bounce to make an award-winning sleep surface. It is fabulous. But now here's the best part. You can sleep on it for 100 nights. And if this isn't the best night's sleep you ever had, you just call them up and they take it back. And they refund you every penny and no harm, no foul. That's U.S. and Canada only, by the way. They don't do that. I guess they can't do that in Estonia yet. I love my Casper. You will love it. They uphold the highest environmental production standards. They're made in the U.S. I don't want to bring this up. I don't know how to say this. There's no off-gassing. They don't smell. Sometimes you think, oh, latex, you're going to... No, it doesn't. It breathes. It is cool in the summertime. It is always comfortable. I think we know now, I think, that one of the best ways to make sure you sleep well is to be not too hot, right? And this mattress really promotes that with the breathable design. There's no springs, no lumps, just comfy support. And the price, $500 for a twin, $950 for a king size, that is so much lower than the mattress you're going to get in the showroom. Trust me. And because you're listening to Floss Weekly, we're going to give you an additional $50 off. All you have to do is go to Casper, that's Casper, Casper.com/floss, and use the promo code Floss, FLOSS. Some terms and conditions apply to that $50 off. For details, you can find out more at Casper.com/terms. Casper Mattresses, 100 nights to try it or return it, and they'll refund every penny. But I think you will not, because I think you're going to love it. $50 off when you use the offer code FLOSS at Casper.com/FLOSS. Now back to the great conversation of Floss Weekly. Thanks, guys.
That, of course, is our executive leader, Leo Laporte, Mr. Twit himself. And Aaron, why don't you go ahead and ask your next question?
Yeah, sure. So I wanted to ask, what's your role in all of this? I mean, we kind of talked about it briefly, but I mean, day to day, what do you actually do for the foundation?
Well, I think that changes almost every day. I mean, Node is growing so fast that they're just the needs that the foundation has kind of change over time. I think, you know, when we started the foundation, there was just a lot of kind of community work to make sure that everybody was on the same page and that the merge happened. And that, you know, honestly, as we scaled up the project, we were thinking about and creating a lot of new governance and community outreach standards and practices and processes. So I worked a lot on that. Now we're in a really, really good place there, though. So lately, I've more been shifting my focus to more of the internal operations of the foundation, making sure that, you know, all of the higher level stuff that we're doing in education and in events is going to work, that we have a much better view of, you know, where people are using Node.js, what the messaging is around it. Definitely looking at a lot of metrics. The project is now so big that we really can't update people using, you know, nice little things that happened to us and stories that we are overheard with people. You know, we're over like 4 million users now, so we really need to pull kind of high-level metrics to figure out what is really going on and what the foundation's role should be in kind of pushing this forward and shepherding it. So that's a lot of what I'm doing lately is, you know, a lot of metrics and operational work.
Cool. And is this something that you've done for a long time? I mean, what is your actual background? Have you worked on other projects? Have you written your own libraries? I mean, what's your background and what have you done that people may know? I think there's something here in the rundown called Request.
Right. So Request was one of the first libraries for Node.js, actually. It predates NPM. But yeah, that's an HTTP library that I wrote that's quite popular. It's one of the most dependent on packages in Node. But I mean, I've been involved in Node since, you know, the first week that it was released and heavily involved in the community. I started the first kind of community conferences around Node, NodeConf, and now there's a lot of those run by different people around the world. Done a lot of just community work in general. I've also been in open source for like 10 years now. So I worked at the Open Source Applications Foundation on the Chandler project. I worked at Mozilla for a while. I worked at Couchbase, like working on the CouchDB stuff. So there's been a lot of open source work that I've done for a long time, and I've done a lot of community work. I've always been more on the community side, more kind of out there working on, you know, events and speaking and kind of trying to figure out, like, how do we bring the people side of this together more than just the technology side.
Cool. I wanted to bring up, I was just doing one of the folks in the chat room, see if I can find it quickly. Jungle in the chat room mentioned an article that was really good. And if you're like me and you're someone that's like, what am I going to use this for? I'm not sure. You might want to go look up this article. It's by Alexandra Grant. And if you do a search for Alexandra Grant in Google, Alexandra Grant, and then put the word gopher in, you'll find this nice article she did called The Way of the Gopher. And what I find interesting about it is that it talks about Node.js and how she used Node.js to solve a problem and what was going on. And I think it just gives a good overview of a concrete problem that Node.js does better than maybe some other languages. And that was going to be my next question, which is, you know, what can I do in Node.js that I couldn't do? I just would just be way too hard to do in Python or Java or even Perl.
Ooh. So I think actually, so I was writing Python for about 5 years before I went over to Node. And back then, Node was not where it is now. It was actually quite difficult to use. But there were a few things that it did so much better that I knew that I wasn't going to use something else. So at the time, I was really trying to bridge an event system with the browser with a platform level. And that was just atrocious to try to do in Python. I mean, I had thousands and thousands of lines of code that to try and make that happen, and it was still like relatively broken. Another thing, you know, I built this project called Windmill, which was like a testing utility, but it had this incredibly advanced, very fast proxy server also in Python. And that proxy was, again, thousands and thousands of lines of code. And one of the first things that I ever wrote in Node was a proxy, just an HTTP proxy. And it was 40 lines of code and significantly faster than the thing that I worked on for 4 years in Python. So, I mean, compared to Python and Ruby as platforms, if you're doing kind of general purpose stuff and you need to be doing I/O fast and efficiently, it's just a lot nicer. And it stops when you hit Control C, which Python won't do. It's like impossible to get Python to just quit. And also I think, you know, as we've gone from 2009 to now, all of these computing environments are getting more constrained. Like, you know, servers are faster, but we're cutting them up into more Docker containers than we ever have before. So you actually get significantly less than a whole processor now, and even less memory all the time. So being fast and efficient is really important. And Node is very good at that. And I would put it up against, you know, any other language that people talk about as being very, very efficient. I think that one of the shifts that we've seen, though, is to more standardized stacks and microservice stacks, right? So you have, you know, stuff like Cloud Foundry and Kubernetes and Docker. And as people invest in these technologies, it really lowers the barrier to entry for developers to use any language in the cloud and in the backend, which is great, right? It means that, you know, if you're a Node shop, you can do a bunch of Node stuff. But if somebody writes an amazing graphing server in Go, you don't have to spin up an entire new set of architecture in order to run that. So there are a lot of, you know, languages that I would consider better in really specific verticals. You know, like people are talking about a lot of really cool stuff that Swift does, and a lot of really cool stuff that Go does. I think that the thing that Node has that nobody else really has is that we run everywhere, and we have the same ecosystem that you can leverage everywhere. And the tools that you're going to use in IoT and in backend, you're also going to be able to use in front end. And I think, you know, it's kind of a luxury to be picking four different languages to build an application when you're, you know, a single developer or a small team. Or even now we're seeing it in enterprise where they just want to have, you know, less teams and less communication overhead. And so they're compiling down basically into, you know, a team of, you know, 6 to 8 people that are doing everything. And even if they have people that work only on the front end and only on the back end, just having the same language and the same dialect and having more agency for the people to be able to travel between these areas has been really, really valuable. So I really feel like, you know, if you're building an application that needs to live in more than one computing environment and stretches these computing environments, that's where Node really shines. Node is the best with all of that. And we also have the largest ecosystem in the world. So if you want to write less of your own code and use more of other people's code, we have the most of that now. So,
darn, you're taking away all of Perl's thunder. I tell you that NPM, I shake my fist at that. Although, you know, it's great because there are definitely people out there that would never touch Perl that would absolutely enjoy JavaScript. I am almost exactly the opposite. So that's the way it is. I'm normally think of Node as being something that would be a server. You put up some sort of server and it has some sort of feature that it's doing, moving stuff around or responding to HTTP or other events, things like that. But how is Node is it even possible to write command line operations with Node? And what is it like to do that?
Oh, yeah, there's a ton of that. Lots and lots of that. In fact, there's a lot of features in NPM that help you do this, that help you, install things that are commands that are actually local commands to a project and then can depend on local dependencies that are running those commands. This thing called NPM scripts. There's also, I mean, when you look at the way that people build front-end applications now, they use these big compiler tools like Babel and JSHint. And there were actually so many tools in the community that they started building tools to manage all of the tools. So you have like Grunt and Gulp and all these other ways in which to manage all of the different tools that you're using to basically write these little shell scripts to compile down all of your front-end stuff. And I mean, people build all kinds of little scripts all the time just to, you know, like there's a lot of new ones now for publishing to Lambda. So there's a million different ways that you might want to package things up and publish them to AWS Lambda or, you know, all the new Lambda competitors. So a lot of those utilities are now written in Node as well, because Node is the first language that was, you know, supported on all these platforms. And we just have such a big ecosystem that can help you build out these command line utilities to do the deploys and publishes and whatnot.
Okay, now as a new person to the NPM environment, or actually to the Node environment entirely, because now I think I want to play with this. I say that at every show, but now it's just driving me nuts again. I see a lot of sort of similar tools, like you just mentioned Grunt and Gulp, and I don't know when to choose one or the other. How do I find out about, best in show for the various competing tools?
Well, you listen to podcasts like Floss Weekly, and you know, whoever sounds the smartest, you go with their utility.
Do I just have to keep reading blog posts and stuff to figure out what's actually covering the space that I need?
You know, this is a constant kind of topic of conversation. And I think a lot of people also tend to look to the foundation to you know, bless something and say, this is the right way to do that. I think that in Node, we definitely take an ecosystem approach to everything. We think that it's a real benefit that we have a lot of tools that have, you know, slightly differing use cases about them. And they may be very similar, but also they are going to appeal to different kinds of people. So, you know, if you sit down and start to play with Grunt or play with Gulp and one appeals more to you, you should definitely go with that. Both of them have, you know, still have very active communities. If you know, something like React really appeals to you, then you should definitely, you know, use tools like React. I think that having a lot of different tools that for people like us that are trying to do a lot of research and find 8 things that do the same thing, it can be a little daunting. But for most people, they're going to find a tool that really appeals to them, that clicks with the way that their brain works, right? Like all of these frameworks have differences. You know, they're built for bigger apps or smaller apps, or, you know, they like, you know, big frameworks or small modules or whatever. And yeah, you're going to end up finding the thing that kind of appeals to you. There is a research phase and a kind of sitting down and getting embedded phase that can be a little daunting to find the right utility. But I don't know. People seem to have really good luck with it, looking at, you know, NPM's growth and Node's growth in general. So people seem to be figuring it out.
And given that NPM is getting bigger and bigger, what kind of search tools do I have to try to identify things that are useful for me that somebody's already published?
Well, NPM has built-in search, but also, I mean, the Node ecosystem is a post-GitHub ecosystem, so just regular Google searches tend to work pretty well because the right, you know, the GitHub packages that people tend to use and reference the most tend to get bumped to the top. So actually just kind of Google searching works pretty well. GitHub searching can work sometimes as well. I mean, there's, you know, the number of modules that are not on GitHub is so such a small percentage that it's basically insignificant. For better or worse, pretty much every Node package is on every NPM package is on GitHub. So.
Oh, cool. Okay, I didn't realize that NPM wasn't its own hosting service.
It is its own hosting service, but it only hosts it's just the CPAN, right? It's not the, you know, version control system and that kind of stuff. So the projects are all on GitHub, but, you know, the published versions and releases of things actually exist inside of NPM.
Okay, and do you want to speak to the recent how half the Node systems in the world got taken out because they got rid of one module?
It wasn't half. It was, you know, a couple very upset people couldn't build for 15 minutes. It really was only 15 minutes too. That was the funny part. So NPM used to allow you to unpublish and to actually remove a version of something. And somebody had a bit of a tantrum and decided to pull down a package that turned out to be really deeply depended on. That means that, you know, dependencies of dependencies of dependencies tend to depend on it. And that was really problematic. So, but, you know, NPM immediately kind of republished it. I mean, it's an open source package. Like, you know, the public has a right to publish that source wherever they want. So they republished it, and then they actually changed the architecture so that you can't unpublish after, I think, 48 hours or something like that. So that won't be happening again, luckily.
We had somebody in the chat room actually ask, how would you contrast this with Go, if I'm familiar with Go?
I think that Go is doing better than I ever thought that a language could do inside of a particular vertical. DevOps in particular, and not just, you know, backend services, but actually even command line utilities, Go is incredibly popular in that particular vertical. I think that, you know, it doesn't run in the browser, and there's really nobody doing browser stuff with it. There's really not any noticeable. There's some IoT stuff, but it's still very kind of hobbyist, and it's not like supported natively on any devices. So, you know, if your only compute environment is a backend, then Go is an option. I think both Node and Go are quite fast. I think when we were really early on, one of the big stories was just how fast we were. And because there weren't a lot of fast languages at the time, I think that we had gone through this period of about a decade where, you know, every language just thought that Moore's Law was going to fix all of their performance issues. And computers were just going to keep getting faster and faster. And then we started going multi-core, and that didn't really work anymore. So Node was very fast, and that was kind of like the shiny thing. Now there's a lot of fast languages, and Go is one of them. So, you know, we compete with them on performance. But they have some interesting patterns that I think for really, really large teams, it's a bit more restrictive of an environment. And in a very, very large team, it can be, helpful to be restrictive. Whereas in Node, it's a bit more kind of creative and loose and relies a little bit more on, you know, programmers to rein themselves in sometimes. That's how I would kind of compare and contrast them.
What kind of frameworks are there for testing this event-driven environment?
Oh, there's a ton. I mean, like every language, there are a million test frameworks. Some of the most popular ones are stuff like Mocha. But there's also several different code coverage utilities that are covered really well. I think that there's a web framework called Happy, H-A-P-I. Everything is Ren and Stimpy themed over in that community, but which is great. but they have a really good test utility, and they also are kind of obsessed with testing and with coverage. So I would actually look to that community and see which coverage tools that they're using, because they're really crazy about this. I mean, they have 100% test coverage and they won't let that change. And so when you send in a PR, like, you have to make sure that all the lines are covered, and they've done a lot of work there. So that's sort of a shining example of how far you can go with test coverage in Node.
I understand that out of the box, Node is only using a single thread. With all these multi-core systems, what's the shortest way to get from there to actually using up all of my machine?
Yeah, so there's a library that it comes with that you can just, you know, spin up other processes and start message passing between them and sharing the core like file system handlers and stuff like that. So that's handled out of the box as a module called Cluster. It's okay. I think that, you know, I get this question less and less every year because the reality is that now, you know, stuff is coming up in a Docker container and it never really gets more than one processor. But we do work on multi-core pretty well. We also have a couple native modules that can also tap into the GPU. So we have, you know, like headless WebGL stuff that taps into the GPU as well. And that's a completely kind of different API. So.
Is there a special relationship between Node and Docker, or are they just both really cool projects and they just happen to work together?
They both just happen to work together really well. No, there's no really official relationship. I think, you know, the Node Foundation is part of the Linux Foundation collaborative projects. So the Linux Foundation handles a lot of our kind of logistics and payroll and stuff like that. And they're amazing to work with. They have amazing marketing and PR and everything like that. And also CII, which is the container initiative and standard, is also inside of Linux. So there's some communication overlap between people, but, you know, like Docker is trying to, you know, maintain language neutrality, you know, with good reason. They don't want to say one language is better than another. They want to be a good platform for every language. And we're really just focused on being fast and efficient, which in a, you know, world where you're cutting up everything into Docker containers or containers in general, that's a good place to be.
Cool. Well, we're almost out of time. We're almost right up against the hard limit on the time here. Is there anything we haven't asked? I got one more question. So what's on the roadmap?
What's on the roadmap? So, you know, this is an interesting question. We get this a lot. And we don't really have a roadmap. And the reason that we don't have a roadmap is that we've optimized the project so that if anybody wants to come in and contribute something, they can. And so the roadmap is whatever the community and the contributors decide to come with good code that they can make it in and make it through review. So there's a lot of things that we want to see happen that we're actively talking about in terms of HTTP2 and VM neutrality and stabilizing our native layer. But honestly, you know, they're going to happen when that code lands and when the kind of people step up. And we found that the best way to incentivize people is to not say, you know, these are our priorities and you know, whatever your priorities are, like, they're second tier. Instead, we're just saying, you know, the roadmap is what people show up to make. You know, the only real scheduling that we have is that every 6 months we have a major release and one of those per year will eventually go into a long-term support cycle. So we just did our third major release since Node and IOJS merged. That's Node v6, and this will go into LTS in about 5 months. So.
And it's available now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Awesome, cool. Well, okay, again, is there any question I haven't asked that you really want to make sure our audience is aware of?
No, this has actually been really great. We kind of covered all the bases. it's been really good. And then I loved, you know, usually I have to, you know, bring up IoT and kind of get that to be part of the story. And it was great to come on and have everybody already so excited about it. So that was awesome. It's been great.
Very cool. Well, and I have to ask two other questions or else I get yelled at. What's your favorite scripting language?
Oh, JavaScript, come on.
Okay, yeah, well, that was easy.
We get fired if I don't say it.
And your favorite text editor?
Right now, it's actually Visual Studio Code. I never thought I would say that. I never thought that I would say I'm running Visual Studio anything. I've been around long enough I know exactly how weird that sounds, but it is an amazing editor. It's basically, you know, like Atom, or, you know, before that I was using TextMate, and it's like all of those editors, but it has those IDE features that are not really heavy-handed. you know, like, it knows more about my code, and that's really nice, but it's not like, you know, trying to tell me like to build at any particular time and things like that. It's a really good balance of advanced IDE features and being an editor and not an IDE.
Okay, and if you had to choose Vim or Emacs?
Oh, I'm a Vim guy. Yeah, yeah. I was like, you know, 12 years old, hand configuring a PPP connection on FreeBSD with VI. So I'm stuck in that forever, I think. Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll grant you all that, because the rest of the show has just been wonderful listening to you talk. I'm sure a lot of people are going to like, wow, I didn't know that you did all this stuff, and go try to download it and play with it and watch the videos, whatever they have to do. So I really appreciate you taking your time, Michael, to talk to us about Node.js and where everything's going with it.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Very good. That was Michael Rogers, who is the community coordinator for Node.js Foundation. Aaron, what'd you think?
Well, this is exciting. I mean, I've got the maker mindset now firmly ingrained, because it's one more tool that I can add to my tool belt of things. It's like, okay, when do I pull out Python? When do I pull out Perl? When do I pull out Java? And now, when do I pull out Node.js? And I think it's important to have those tools. You know, it's difficult to be a master of many languages, just like, you know, real languages from other countries. It's hard to master all of them well, but I think if you know a little bit about them, especially if you're a maker like me and you just need to do a little project, it's like, oh yeah, yeah, I know I could do that in Node and it'll run really well. So it's just nice to have, and I think it's good to see that they're over their problems that they had there temporarily, and things are rolling along, and I'm really glad to see that now the foundation and the community, it's all coming together and it's cohesive, and so that's always good to see for any open source project, I think.
Yeah, and you know, it's although I sort of poo-poo JavaScript, I'm actually getting pretty good at it. I've been doing a lot of jQuery work and things like that. Now I'm learning Angular to try to get more reactive front end stuff, smarter front ends. Also, I want to learn Angular because I can apply what I learn it in JavaScript, Angular 2, right directly to Dart as well. And I really do want to program more in Dart. So I'm one of those guys that he thinks doesn't exist. So more and more people are actually using Dart. I keep hearing that from the people at Google. But yeah, this is a good show. And like I said, we're running long. So let me start the last bit of everything I have to do for the end of this show, because we do have some upcoming guests. We are live at OSCON next week. I have two people I'm in contact with, two different projects, and both of them look like they could easily do the live slot while I'm at OSCON. That's actually in Austin, OSCON, right? And then following that, we have the Best Practices badge, where you can say, hey, I'm following best practices, and get other people interested in following best practices for their particular applications and projects. And right after that, Varnish Cache. Varnish is being used by some of the biggest websites in the world to speed up how fast they deploy their pages by compressing CSS or compressing JavaScript, caching things, all sorts of wonderful stuff like that. So we'll bring on one of the senior project leaders, project managers from Varnish. We have a lot of open slots immediately after that. I hope to fill all of them by having been at OSCON next week, because I always run around and try to find projects to do and I try to get them in as quick as I can so that we have contemporary information. So we still are filling Q2. If you have anybody that is not on the list that you can get to from twitch.tv/floss, the big spreadsheet is linked from there. If there's somebody not on that list, please have contact the community coordinator like Michael is, or maybe the project leader, and say, I really want your project to be on Floss Weekly. Here's the email address, write merlin@stonehenge.com, and I will work with them to put them on the queue. We'll probably open up Q3 next week. We have a live stream. We took some questions from there today. It's at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays at live.twit.tv. You can follow us at Floss Weekly on Google Plus or at Floss Weekly, where it's automatically tweeted over to. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus, which is also tweeted over to Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N. As I said, next week I am going to be at OSCON down in Austin, right where they just canceled Uber and Lyft service. Bad. So I'll have to take regular taxis for a change. Oh, my God. And after that, about 2 weeks after that, I'm going to be in Orlando, Florida at YAPSE North America. That's the Yet Another Pearl Conference. And I'll be looking for Floss Weekly projects there as well. Just invited, just got to get added to the Red Hat Summit in San Francisco. So I have not been to San Francisco probably in 2 years. I'm going to really enjoy my 4 or 5 days there. And then immediately after that, back in Austin again, not immediately, there's like some gap in a few days between each of these. I'm going to be at the Texas Linux Fest, and that again is in Austin at the thing there. So that I was there probably 10 years ago, 12 years ago, gave a talk. And now I go back as Floss Weekly to try to find, again, more projects to talk about on this show. I mentioned a few times that I was going to FISLE, the big conference in Porto Alegre, Brazil. I am unfortunately not going to go because I fear being a vector for Zika. I just don't want to have that anywhere remotely in my possibility of existence. So I do not want to come. Probably next year I'll go back. And then DragonCon coming up in September. Probably do some stuff. I'm on the EFF track and possibly on the podcasting track, so I'll probably cover things like computers and the law and protecting yourself and talk about the Mozilla project that we had a few weeks ago on as well. All right, that's all my plugs. Aaron, what do you want to plug?
That's a lot of plugs. You're going to be busy.
I am. Unfortunately, all non-billable time, so that's the second part.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you can always follow me on Google+. I hang out there, I have to say, less and less these days, but when I do post something or if I do want to interact with somebody, it's usually through Google+. So go to Google+, and just look me up there. I'm Aaron Newcomb on Google+. And I guess the other big news I have is, and I think I talked about this on the new Screensavers when I was on with Leo a couple weeks ago, is I'm writing a book. The book is tentatively titled Linux for Makers. So I'll be talking all about all of the tough stuff that when people are new to Linux and they want to build a project and they get their Raspberry Pi up and running, and then they realize, oh, crap, I got to use Linux. Well, I don't really know this. So so that's what this book is all about. It's to help those people who are kind of new to Linux and how to use all the tools, again, out of their tool belt for making things on Linux. So with that in mind, if you have any suggestions about things that were difficult for you to learn when you first started using Linux, I'd love to know about them so that I can include helpful tips and hints in this book to help other users who may be having the same problem. So the best way to do that is just to use the hashtag Linux4Makers. Linux for Makers, and I'll pick that up on Twitter and try to include some answers to some tough problems in the book for new users. So there you go.
And is this going to be an open source book?
It is, actually. This is going to be published through the Make Media. And I don't know if their stuff is all open source. Probably not, actually. It's because it's going to go through O'Reilly too. So I don't know how they handle that. But it'll be cheap and easy to get, I can tell you that.
Awesome. Well, I wish you luck. Have fun earning your minimum wage for 9 months.
Yeah, definitely.
Been there, done that 2 or 3 times now. You know, I believe it or not, you don't make any money off of books that are technology books, like, unless they're a super bestseller. I mean, at one point, I thought I could get maybe the car payment out of the sales of the Camel book, and I ended up actually pulling in, a small house payment, let's put it that way. But my book, the Campbell book, was wildly successful, way beyond anybody's expectations, you know, selling like 10 times what we thought it was going to sell. So I lucked out there. I'm very happy to have contributed to 3 or 4 of the best-selling Pearl books ever in the universe. So I've made a little bit of money. Still making a little bit of money, but it's very, very little. You make about 50 cents a book, basically. So that's
it's definitely tough to do as a day job, that's for sure. Not going to happen.
And actually, people have wondered why I haven't written another book, and I go, I don't want to work for minimum wage. Even if minimum wage goes up to $15 an hour, it's still not enough. Yeah. So no, definitely not. All right, I'm taking up too much time. We'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.